gentlemen. We're pleased to have District Judge Shadid of the Central District of Illinois sitting with us today.
Good morning.
Welcome to the court.
Thank you. Good morning.
Our first case for argument this morning is American Safety Casualty against the City of Waukegan. Mr. Phillip.
Good morning, Your Honor, and may
Pause
it please
briefly.
The court.
I want to say good morning to Judge.
Good morning. Good morning to everyone, and may it please the court. My name is Mark Phillip, and I represent the appellant Interstate Indemnity Company in this case. In this case, we respectfully request that you reverse the judgment of the district court insofar as it held that Interstate was obliged to pay a portion of Waukegan's damages related to the wrongful prosecution, conviction, and imprisonment of an Illinois citizen, Mr. Dominguez, all of which occurred from 1989 through 1993. And we respectfully ask this court to reverse because the result below was inconsistent with the language of the relevant interstate insurance policy, and because the decision of this court that the district court relied on, this court's recent McFatridge decision, was decided with deficient briefing from the parties on the particular issue relevant here. So we respectfully submit that the McFatridge case made a prediction about Illinois law that's inconsistent with the vast bulk of relevant authorities.
Has any Illinois decision suggested disagreement with McFatridge?
No, sir. There hasn't been a comment on it one way or the other. There is not.
Is there anything that would keep Illinois courts from deciding this issue? And I'm sometimes inclined to certify an issue if the way in which it sets up means it always ends in federal court. Is there anything that would mean that this kind of dispute always comes to federal court?
I don't think there's a requirement that the case necessarily will come to federal court in the consideration.
There are a lot of in-state insurers or insurers with at least one citizenship in Illinois, so in declaratory judgment actions they would just be locked into state court.
It could be the case, Your Honor. The reason why, and that's certainly a relevant consideration, the reason why we think reconsideration here is appropriate or certification in the alternative is because there'll be practical real-world consequences immediately.
I can certainly imagine that, but of course Illinois has the tools. If they don't think McFatridge is right, Illinois has the tools. They can just disagree with it. And we're playing the role of ventriloquist dummy. Some people emphasize the ventriloquist part. Some people emphasize the dummy part. Illinois can get out. Okay, so that's one. Second question I have, although perhaps you representing an excess carrier aren't the right person to talk about it, is I don't understand why we are having this dispute. That is, why we have a series of disputes between the city of Waukegan on one side and an insurance carrier on the other. As it looks to me like the city of Waukegan had insurance for every possible triggering period. Had insurance for 90, had insurance for 91, had insurance for 2002, had insurance in between. To an outsider, it looks like it has a 100% entitlement to a defense, and the real fight is among the carriers about which carrier is responsible. And you would think then what would happen is the carriers would get together, they would say, okay, we provide our client with a defense, and we will work out among ourselves who pays in the end. But instead what happened in this case is everybody denies liability, everybody leaves the city in the lurch, and then when there's a big judgment, the insurers get all upset. Well, that seems to be the result of completely irresponsible behavior. So why didn't the insurance carriers do this the right way?
Your Honor, I don't know the factual answer to that, and it's not in the record, so I don't mean to overrepresent my knowledge here.
Yeah, well, I said you representing an excess carrier may be the wrong party to ask because you didn't have the duty of defense. Well, your client didn't have the duty of defense.
I understand, sir. So I think that's a question probably for another party.
I hope everybody's heard it, because I'll be asking it often.
One thing, sir, about this court's task of predicting how the Illinois Supreme Court might pass on the question that I think is centrally relevant. To our knowledge in looking at all the cases that have come down on this issue, there has never been a time that any panel, any court, has ever chosen to break from the majority position when it was apprised of the two lines of authority that are out there, as best we can tell. The two cases that have gone the other way in the last 30 years, in the time period where these lines of authority have developed, were one intermediate court from Louisiana that didn't cite anything, and then this court's McFatrin.
That I understand. But I've now got just a policy question for you, and this is equally applicable for the other carriers and, for that matter, the insurance industry amicus brief. I don't understand why the insurers want liability with a long tail. If I understand the normal desire of carriers, it's to have their liability on a policy resolved as quickly as possible. But the kind of argument you're making here is that you issue an insurance policy covering 1990, the claim may not be made until 2000 or 2005 or 2010, rather than having a situation in which the claim is made close to contemporaneous with the policy. So why does the insurance industry want a long tail on liability?
I think the reason why the industry, Your Honor, wants it is because that's how the landscape has developed nationally and to maintain consistency. I actually, not to answer your question with a question, I wonder why the cities want to have this liability where, in effect, they have to each year pay for a lifetime's worth of potential contingent liability in the past.
Of course, the city is going to buy a policy anyway, unless the city is planning on going out of business. If the city is planning on going out of business, then, you know, having to buy the lifetime of policies is a worry. But Waukegan isn't planning to, say, be the subject of a hostile takeover by Argentina or anything like that.
No, I don't mean to imply that, sir. I just meant that in this case, for example, if the policies were interpreted with the majority position, Waukegan already is covered for all the prior years, and so all it needs to do is cover 1 year going forward. If it goes forward, for example, there's a decision coming to this court referenced in the brief called the Northfield case, in which right now it's on an interlocutory appeal in the Illinois courts. There'll be a gap in coverage that'll likely eventuate before that decision comes to this court for an interpretation of coverage. Waukegan will have to buy coverage both for the Northfield decision related to acts in the past, and it will have to buy coverage for all the other potentially vulnerable convictions of the past that haven't yet, quote unquote, come home to roost. So I think in either scenario, there's going to be costs associated with it. We respectfully suggest that if the Illinois Supreme Court were presented with this decision, or with this issue, it would side with that uniform or nearly uniform majority view for the reasons that all the other courts have when they've had that issue open before them. One thing with respect to the language of the interstate policy, sir, it as interpreted, if we put McFatridge aside for a moment, it is an occurrence policy based on with coverage triggered when there is a personal injury or a personal injury and advertising offense to include malicious prosecution or abuse of process. So under that policy, there's nothing at all that would suggest, with all respect, coverage triggered by exoneration or a subsequent judgment in a wrongful prosecution suit. So here, we believe the facts indicate that personal injury was suffered by Mr. Dominguez back when he was in prison, back when he was being prosecuted. It ended at a minimum when he was released from jail in 93. During the coverage period that Interstate has, 2001 to 2002, the only thing that happened was that he was exonerated, which is neither an offense against him nor harm nor damage to him. It's a positive development as to him. And then there isn't even liability that's established. There isn't even a lawsuit filed until 2004 and then a judgment entered in his behalf in front of Judge Shader in 2006. So we think that under the contract, under this occurrence-based contract, the relevant trigger is, in fact, as the majority of cases, roughly 20 of them, have held, the relevant period is that initiation of the prosecution against him or the harm he suffers. Here they're essentially intertwined, all of which occurred at least 8 years before the policy at issue here of Interstates. We'd also respectfully suggest that this is a case where if there is ambiguity, we think it is a fair case to certify to the Illinois Supreme Court. not because the Illinois courts will never get the question. Eventually they will. But because there are practical, real-world consequences here for insurers, for cities who are having to purchase insurance in terms of the costs that they'll be that they'll have to bear, that militate in favor of having the issue resolved sooner rather than later, and not having it hang out there. It's a fairly discrete issue. It's an issue we think that the Illinois Supreme Court would choose to side with the majority. As I said, there's no decision of any court, to our knowledge, that has been apprised of these two lines of disparate authorities and has chosen the minority view when it was apprised of the majority view. We cite an awful lot of cases in the brief. There's a lot of arguments in those and in the brief discussed as to why that majority position we think is the better one. But it also is a virtue of being the majority position and doesn't require cities in Illinois and insurance carriers in Illinois to contract around that decision. We think the contract as written and as explained is already quite clear, and that the outcome there that the industry has developed is a sensible one. One thing about McFatridge that I want to make clear to this court, please, there are several holdings in McFatridge. We don't take any issue with any of them except one, and that was the issue. And one could argue, as this court's jurisprudence has indicated, about whether it's technically dicta or technically an alternative holding. And I think there's fair arguments on either side of that. I think the bottom line is it's not a core part we'd respectfully submit of the McFatridge decision. It wasn't, as best we can tell from the briefing, really squared up for this court with a full appraisal of the relevant authority on the other side. And nothing in the McFatridge decision.
In other words, the court in McFatridge made the terrible mistake of agreeing with the insurance carriers there.
No, sir. I wouldn't put it that way. I just think that the parties.
I think it is hilarious because that's what happened. We agreed with the carriers in McFatridge, and now the Insurance Industry Association is saying, help, help, rescue us.
I think, sir, the result in McFatridge, I think the insurers agree with, and I think they'll agree with that result when the Northridge case comes up. The result is a sound one. It's this aspect, this alternative aspect of the holding, which wasn't essential to the result, and as best we can tell, has never driven the result in any case that's occurred, that's come before this court. The next case where it'll be relevant, potentially perhaps, is the Northfield case that's on its way to on appeal to you. So I notice the light's on. I've got some time reserved for rebuttal. We would respectfully ask this court either to reverse that one aspect of McFatridge that made a prediction about what the Illinois Supreme Court would do, to bring the prediction in line with the vast bulk of authority on this issue, or in the alternative, we'd respectfully request for the Illinois courts to have the chance to pass on that issue themselves, not just because it's theoretically important, all legal issues have some theoretical significance, but because it has very real practical consequences for the insurance industries and cities in Illinois. Thank you.
Thank
all
you,
very,
Mr.
very much.
May it please the Court. Your Honor, I'd like to address the first question you asked. Why are we here? We're here because the City of Waukegan has every year, as Your Honor pointed out, purchased an occurrence-based policy. All these policies, there's no dispute here, are occurrence-based policies. Under an occurrence-based policy, they insure for an offense which is committed during the term of the policy. We're here because the City of Waukegan had an insurance carrier on this risk from the period of 1990 through 1991, when the arrest and conviction of Mr. Dominguez took place. That insurance carrier, Scottsdale, was not given proper notice and so was granted summary judgment. As a result, the city came after all the other insurers who were serially on this risk in the subsequent years. That is why we're here. I would like to address your...
Still isn't addressing my question. It's perfectly plain that the City of Waukegan is entitled to defense and indemnity from one, at least, of these multiple carriers.
Absolutely agree, Your Honor.
But what has happened is that each of the carriers has serially denied liability and has litigated not with the other carriers to see who is responsible, but has litigated with the city. And all carriers collectively have left their insured in the lurch.
I respectfully,
that's the problem.
I respectfully disagree. The carrier that was on the risk at the time and for whom there is with whom there is coverage was Scottsdale. The city failed to give.
That's what you say, but that's true only if McFatridge is wrong, right? There are arguments that are being made about why Scottsdale is liable or why American Safety is liable. I can imagine arguments about the intervening carriers being liable. The question I ask Mr. Phillip and still have is, given that fact, why hasn't the industry, you know, the collective of all potentially liable carriers stepped forward, given a defense, and then worked out among themselves who is liable, rather than leaving their client undefended?
And I think the answer to that, Your Honor, is because these are contracts of insurance, and contracts are subject to basic contract interpretation. And each of these contracts insures for a particular period. There are occurrence-based policies. No one contests that.
I'm aware of that. But you're just not dealing with my question. The uncertainty is not, is the city covered? It is. The uncertainty is who covers the city, which carrier covers the city.
That's correct.
Which suggests that the right litigation is among the carriers, not between the carriers and the city.
And
it's perfectly understandable in this case why the district judge invoked Section 155. District judge thought, I'm inclined to think, that the carriers as a group have behaved irresponsibly toward their client.
And we believe that the carriers have not behaved irresponsibly. I see that my light is on, Your Honor. Our policy clearly states that insures for a loss that occurs during the policy period. The occurrence is defined as a personal injury offense which takes place in the course of law enforcement activity. There was no law enforcement activity or personal injury offense which took place in 2002. Nothing that occurred during that period of time.
Is there an occurrence until somebody knows it in 1990?
Well, the city knew that there was an occurrence as soon as it was apprised of it at the time that Mr. Dominguez was exonerated, and that triggers the tort of malicious prosecution.
But in 1990, only Dominguez knew it, right? In a sense.
That's true, yes. Okay. And that's the situation we have in all of these cases where later on a victim is exonerated.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Asperger.
May it please the court.
Petretti.
Good morning. Paulette Petretti on behalf of the City of Waukegan. Your Honors, the city is here today both as an appellee and as a cross-appellant. And first, I'd like to try to cover five general points as appellee. In summary, first, we're going to maintain that the carrier's policies were triggered by allegations of an offense of deprivation of due process or malicious prosecution. The federal offense at issue occurred when Dominguez was exonerated on April 26, 2002, a date that occurred within both American Safety's and Interstate's policies. Second, I want to talk.
Did the city ever try to get the carriers to fight this out among themselves?
Your Honor, yes. In response to your question about leaving the city in a lurch, we did on numerous occasions attempt to get them to come together and settle. And it was truly mind-boggling that it was almost like a conspiracy of insurers against the city. And it was, I can't answer you why that occurred, but we did attempt on several occasions to try to bring settlement about. Your Honor, we're also going to be talking about American Safety's duty to defend and how they breached it, and therefore they're stopped from raising policy defenses under Illinois law. American Safety's vexatious and unreasonable conduct. We'll argue that McFatridge should not be overturned, and the motion to certify the triggering event to the Illinois Supreme Court should be denied.
Why do you care about McFatridge? No, let me take it back. I understand why you care about McFatridge here, because the city fell asleep at the wheel and didn't notify one of the carriers in time. But In general, does the city have any preference for McFatridge over some other rule?
Your Honor, I don't think the city fell asleep at the wheel with regard to Scottsdale.
The city's notification of Scottsdale was years late. You know, I understand you're going to argue that there wasn't any prejudice in all of that, but it was years late. Right? But I want you to address the question whether the city thinks McFatridge is a good approach as a general matter, right? Assuming everybody's notified in time.
Yes.
Why does the city care?
Well, I think it's a good rule of law. In McFatridge, the court looked not only at a federal due process claim and analyzed it under Heck versus Humphrey, and also looked at a state malicious prosecution claim. And I think the rule of law is a very sound one, especially under Heck versus Humphrey, which talks about when damages accrue. And that's what insurance is all about.
The assumption of McFatridge is that the occurrence occurs for purposes of a policy at the time when somebody can sue in tort. So here's a perfectly normal thing. Now, auto manufacturer makes a car with a hidden defect, with an axle that's going to fall apart, right? And that happens in year one when policy number one is in force. The axle actually falls apart in year two, and somebody is injured. As a matter of Illinois law, which policy applies, the year one policy or the year two policy?
Well, there may be some liability for both of those carriers.
No, that's extremely unlikely, right? Which of those policies apply? McFatridge approaches this on the assumption that the year two policy applies because that's when the tort occurred. That's when all the elements of the tort have occurred. I think the implication of the Insurance Industry Association's brief is the claim is against the issuer of the year one policy, and I just wonder which of these is correct under Illinois law.
I believe that the year that the injuries actually, all the elements of the cause of action come into fruition and when the damages are assessed.
Some case where we can go and find that?
Heck versus Humphrey. I think that is a seminal case which it really governs in this case because we have a federal due process claim. The claim went to the court on a federal due process claim, Dominguez's claim.
I know that. As a matter of both Heck and the Illinois law of malicious prosecution, the claim didn't accrue till 2002.
Right.
But that is not a doctrine of insurance law. Right? It seems to me that McFatridge is decided by whatever principle decides which of these two carriers in my auto insurance case is responsible. I would really love to know, under Illinois law, which year it is.
Well, I think you have to look at the insurance policies as well. And under American Safety and Interstate's policies, the personal injuries that are due to an offense of malicious prosecution or a deprivation of due process is what triggers the liability. So when you use the word offense, that comes with it all the requisite elements of the offense. So in this particular case, you have to look at the elements for deprivation of due process or malicious prosecution, which not only requires that there is a malicious prosecution and charges were brought, but it also requires the favorable termination in favor of the plaintiff. That favorable termination is an essential element, and that's why we argue that the cases in the so-called majority that they have brought up, I'm not sure what majority it is because it's just a mishmash of cases, some federal, some state from around the country, they do not analyze all the elements of the offense. And in this case, to me it's crystal clear, and McFatridge is right on target, because in McFatridge, all the elements of the torts, and here we have a constitutional tort, had to be in place in order to trigger liability. And that's when the damages are fixed and actual. Before that time, especially for insurance purposes, you don't have any damages until that point where he's exonerated. So we maintain that this is not a policy where it's wrongful acts. The policy clearly states, and when you look at their insuring agreements, you'll see the insuring agreement provides that it is an offense of malicious prosecution.
Who did the city notify first?
The city
Scottsdale or
American states?
Well, Your Honor, the city notified all of the carriers once they got
notice of the
claim. They tried. You know, this when this happened in 2004, they had to go back to 1989. So there was a process of looking through the files to determine who the carriers were. And this goes to the Scottsdale issue. With regard to Scottsdale, during that time period, 1988 to 1991, when Scottsdale had law enforcement, the city had a package policy from International Specialty Risk, and they notified International. What happened over the years is that it was determined that that package did not include law enforcement. There was a standalone policy, and that was not determined until later. And as soon as they found out, they notified Scottsdale. So,
well, I asked the question because assuming Scottsdale was notified properly, I'll use that word, and accepted coverage, we wouldn't be having this discussion, right?
Your Honor, that would be subject to debate because we notified everybody. All the carriers were on notice.
Okay.
So it wasn't just one. Because, in fact, Your Honor, I think we would be having a debate. When it was first looked at and analyzed, the defense counsel said, well, the false arrest, because there was a false arrest claim, is triggered at the time of the arrest. However, the malicious prosecution is triggered at the time of the exoneration. So from the get-go, there were the two views, which are exactly what is set forth in McFatridge. And under Wallace v. Cato and Heck v. Humphrey, those are two discrete torts. And so there would be two triggers in that case.
Okay.
So I think we still would be having a dispute. In our brief, you know, we really take issue with all of the cases that they have cited from around the country. Those cases rely on the gist or the essence of the offense rather than all the elements, and we think that they are wrongly decided. They really just look upon the favorable termination as a conditioned precedent. And if you look at the real elements, the favorable termination is an essential element. And so we maintain that is what triggered the liability in this case. I would like to talk a little bit about the duty to defend under American Safety. They had a duty to defend. They were notified in a timely fashion, and they even appeared providing a defense. They assigned a claims analyst. They asked for regular status reports. They communicated with the city's third-party administrator, and they communicated with Interstate, which was the excess carrier. And the city was led to believe that they were providing coverage. And then merely a few days before trial, they turned heel on the city and said, you know, the date of loss is the date of the arrest. We're not covering this. And they walked away. And the city was, I mean, clearly devastated, left high and dry, went to trial, and American Safety was not seen of or heard of again until 7 months later they went into federal court and filed a declaratory judgment action. And their conduct, as we've laid out in the brief, we think is classically vexatious and unreasonable, and it's a textbook example of what an insurer should not do to an insured. Their duty is very clear under Illinois law. Employers Insurance Wausau versus Elko Liquidating Trust. American Safety has also raised some policy defenses. As we say, under Elko, since they breached their duty to defend, they did not appear and defend under a reservation of rights. They did not file a timely declaratory judgment action. Under ELCO, a declaratory judgment that is filed after the judgment is rendered is untimely as a matter of law. And so, therefore, the consequences are they are stopped from raising policy defenses. So all of the policy defenses that they have raised, we believe they are barred from raising. I would like to just address briefly, the cross appellant, our position with Scottsdale. As I briefly responded to the questions regarding the notice, the city did give notice to Scottsdale before trial. Granted, it was a week before trial. It's not maximum, but they did get notice. And earlier than that, the city had given notice to the broker that sold the policies. One of the issues that we brought up at the district court is the agency issue. Whether or not notice to the broker was tantamount to notice to Scottsdale. That issue was never allowed to be explored because the judge granted summary judgment before we had an opportunity to do discovery on that. But regardless, even if you just look purely at and apply ELCO, you strictly apply ELCO to Scottsdale, we gave Scottsdale notice 1 week before trial. Scottsdale could have stepped in and appeared and defended, or they could have filed a declaratory judgment. Their declaratory judgment that they filed after the judgment was rendered was based on one thing. It was based on late notice. It was a very simple declaratory judgment. There's no reason that it could not have been raised at the time that we provided notice. So there is a question as to why Scottsdale waited so long. They waited almost 4 months to file a declaratory judgment. So if you strictly construe ELCO, we maintain that Scottsdale breached its duty to defend and therefore is stopped under ELCO from raising policy defenses, and one of those policy defenses would be the late notice. And under ELCO, it is deemed that late notice is not a defense if you breach your duty to defend. So with regard to...
is there any Illinois case that holds that a carrier has to step in and assume a defense when it's notified 6 days before trial begins after, say, 3 years of discovery and litigation?
Well, Your Honor, it wasn't 3 years. It was only 2 years. Yes. But
you have my question, right? The district judge said, you know, there are all sorts of state cases, but she couldn't find any that said that a carrier notified 6 days before the start of trial had to drop everything in the world and scramble. Do you know of any such state case?
Well, I would apply ELCO and its progeny.
ELCO isn't remotely similar. If you would deal with my question, it may be the answer is no, and then you're asking us to, you know, bend state law in your favor. But do you know of any such case?
Well, Your Honor, I beg to differ. I do think that ELCO...
Right. You can either answer my question, or I will assume that the answer is no.
I can't give you a name of a case right this minute. No.
Okay.
I cannot. But I do believe that if there is a bright line that's established by the Illinois Supreme Court, I don't know how you can alter that or modify it. And when does that bright line move? The ELCO court said if the declaratory judgment is filed after the case is resolved by judgment or settlement, it's late as a matter of law.
So on your view, if you had first notified Scottsdale after the judgment, then since it would have been impossible for Scottsdale to file a declaratory judgment suit before the judgment, then necessarily Scottsdale would be liable because lateness is irrelevant and Scottsdale hadn't acted in time, QED. You can't mean that, can you?
I don't mean that.
Right.
Because
so we're back to my question, which is if instead of waiting until after the judgment to notify the carrier, you notify them so late in the process that, you know, large institutions can't act in 6 days. They can't gather all the information and hire a law firm and do all the investigation that's required. Right, you might as well have waited until after the trial.
Your Honor, I think that there is a question there of fact, and because reasonableness of Scottsdale's conduct was at issue, the reasonableness of the notice also is an issue of fact.
I'm talking about the reasonableness of the carrier's behavior. The city's behavior with respect to Scottsdale was so unreasonable, and the arguments you're making now are so unreasonable, that it draws into question the bona fides of all your other arguments.
Well, Your Honor, I think that it is, we've raised it because it's a rule of law.
But you've already told me that you can't wait till after the verdict, notify the carrier, and then say you're estopped because you didn't have ESP, right? So you can't mean that that is a rule of law.
Well, no, because then the carrier really would not have had any opportunity to participate. But in this case, there was an opportunity. So, Your Honor, we do maintain that it's just we ask the court to look at ELCO and use a strict application of that. With regard to the issue of overruling McFatridge, we believe that it is based on governing law, and it should not be overturned. With regard to certifying this to the Illinois Supreme Court, this is a federal question. It's a federal due process question. And we don't believe that turning this over to the Illinois Supreme Court would be appropriate.
The question here is when the occurrence occurred for purposes of policies of insurance. That's not a question of federal law.
But under the policies cover violations of constitutional rights. And that does invoke federal law, because you have to look at Heck versus Humphrey, Wallace v. Cato, in those cases, just as McFatridge did. That's the issue before this court. What is the triggering event for constitutional?
I'm just lost. Come back to my earlier example. As a matter of law, there is no tort without injury, and therefore nobody can sue on the broken axle that was defective when the auto left the plant until the axle breaks. But it may be perfectly plausible for a state court to hold that the insurance policy that covers it is the insurance policy in force when the car was made defectively. Right? Federal law tells us that it's not possible to sue until exoneration. But it may be perfectly possible for state law to say the claim accrues earlier. This cannot be an issue of federal law.
Well, but because the tort is a constitutional tort, 42 U.S.C. Section 1983, we maintain that the state court would have to look at federal law to determine when that cause of action accrues and what the elements of that cause of action are. It's not totally dependent on Illinois law.
But your assumption now seems to be that there can be no occurrence within the meaning of an insurance policy until the claim has accrued and it is possible to sue. So, in other words, you're assuming that in my defective auto example, it would be year two. The carrier in force in year two would be the one who is on the hook for coverage. Now, if I were sure that that was the law of Illinois, your argument would be straightforward. But I don't know whether that's the law of Illinois.
What I'm unclear about, and I understand the difficult position you're in because you had insurance coverage for 15 years running and you find yourself standing here arguing for insurance coverage. But if Scottsdale had been, and I asked it earlier, but is the city arguing that McFatridge is good law because that's all what you have left? Or if Scottsdale had been notified and provided coverage, would the city care about McFatridge?
Well, yes.
You see what I'm saying?
Yes. And I go back to the original analysis that there were triggering events even when we looked at this case back in 2004 for the arrest and also for the exoneration. So, and that was just based on Illinois law and when those torts accrue. So under Illinois law, the tort of malicious prosecution accrues when there is a favorable termination. So, yes, we did look at both initially. And, of course, I think McFatridge deals with both ends of the spectrum. I mean, it does. So under McFatridge, there would be some liability for both. Now, the damages under a false arrest are very limited, and especially if you look at Heck versus Humphrey and Wallace v. Cato. It's only from the time that the false arrest occurs until it's turned over to a magistrate or for arraignment that those damages accrue. All the other damages go when the reversal in favor of the plaintiff occurs. So all those damages, that's why we think in this case the district court was absolutely correct and in keeping with what McFatridge held, that all those damages will materialize and become accessible at the time that there's a favorable termination. With regard to state court, the Security Mutual case, there's no reason to believe that that would be overturned. When it was produced back in the late 70s, it did go up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court had an opportunity to overturn it at that time, but did not. It just overturned on the issue of arbitrability. And knowing that that was a case of first impression at the time, that no other court had dealt with when insurance policies were triggered for purposes of malicious prosecution, one would believe that the Supreme Court, in a position like that, would have, if it believed it was erroneous, would have overturned it at that time, but it did not. It simply sent it back for arbitration, and it signaled, in my opinion, that the appellate court had gotten it right. So I don't even know that...
Well, save any time to respond to Safeco. Now is the time to do it.
The time to what?
To do it.
I'm sorry, to respond?
You asked the court for leave to respond to Safeco for a period. Your white light is now on. Your time is running short.
To Scottsdale, Your Honor.
Scottsdale, I'm sorry.
I thought maybe that was the case. Yes, and the Scottsdale, as we said, our position with Scottsdale is that we did give notice, and there is that question of fact of whether the notice to the broker was notice to Scottsdale. That occurred in April of 2005. We were not given an opportunity to explore that through discovery, and we do believe that that was a question of fact. If, in fact, there was notice, then Scottsdale may have breached its duty, and insurance code violations perhaps would be in order. Scottsdale did have a policy at the time of the false arrest, so the damages with regard to Scottsdale would be limited. The case of Dominguez's civil rights case did not go to the jury on the false arrest. That was dismissed on a statute of limitations issue. So the case went to the jury on a deprivation of due process, and the damages flowing from that would be all the damages go back to the from the time of arrest all the way through the time of his case, and that is supported by Heck versus Humphrey. Your Honor, if there are no further questions, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Crouch.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Thomas Crouch on behalf of Scottsdale. I suppose if there were somebody who's trying to script a set of facts that would show late notice as a matter of law, they could just look to the undisputed facts of this case. I'm not going to repeat them there. I think the court has an understanding of the significant delay in notice to my client. I'm just going to mention a couple things on that topic. The Elko case, I think, specifically contemplates exactly this situation when it spoke of the rule only applying where the insurer had a duty, both the existence of a duty and a breach of the duty, and noted that a carrier that's not given an opportunity to defend, the estoppel rule doesn't even apply in that situation. Here, Scottsdale receiving notice just a couple days before, I guess we can argue whether it's 4 days before, which is the date they received the notice, or 6 days before, which is the date of the notice, but the undisputed fact is they did not have an opportunity to defend, and therefore the estoppel rule addressed in Elko has no application here. But even if the rule were applied, the time requirement is one of reasonableness, and Scottsdale's declaratory judgment action commenced only a few months later is timely. There's this argument by the city that there's an absolute rule requiring that the action be commenced before judgment. I think that's a little distortion of ELCO. I believe the language is that it must be commenced before resolution of the final resolution of the underlying case. Here, of course, Scottsdale commenced its declaratory action in January of 07, and while the jury had certainly returned a verdict a few weeks after Scottsdale got notice, the case continued on post-trial motions and an appeal to this court, and its final resolution was not until probably more than a year after Scottsdale commenced its action. The reference to the agent issue, I would just urge the court to refer to the actual communication that they're talking about, which is on pages 256 and 257 of the city's appendix, which is SA 256-257. And when you read that, you will see that it was a brief communication with a representative of Arthur J. Gallagher asking for the address of another carrier. And that communication could not possibly be construed as a notice to Scottsdale through an agent. City had all the time in the world to prepare its response to the summary judgment motion, had more than a year after commencement of the case before the summary judgment was filed. If it wanted to seek additional time for discovery, it could have asked, and it did not do so. It presented no evidence to create a genuine issue on the timeliness of notice or any agency issues. I had to chuckle, Your Honor, with your comment about the insurance industry coming in to say, wait a minute, what happened in McFatridge? Obviously, my client was in that case, so you probably would not have been shocked to see Section 5 of my brief where I had to take issue with my colleague, Laura Foggin, and the AIA. If there is one thing I think the entire insurance industry can agree upon, is that it wants courts ruling on the particular language at issue in the case. And we have spoken, well, I haven't spoken, I suppose. I've been listening intently at my table, but I've listened to discussions of the broad issue of occurrence policies and what the insurance industry does or doesn't want, and perhaps what insureds want or don't want. I want this court to look at the particular language at issue and come to its considered judgment on that issue. And I happen to disagree with the amicus that submitted a brief in this case. I think this case involves unique language in the American safety policy. I don't think that addressing the particular language at issue in this case will create some sort of grand revolution on the issue of trigger of coverage in these types of cases. And so I submitted those arguments in Section 5 of my brief, suggesting that perhaps the amicus doesn't have it right. Perhaps the amicus isn't speaking on behalf of the insurance industry as a whole, and it certainly wasn't speaking on behalf of Scottsdale. I believe my colleague made a point that I would have made at the conclusion of her argument, and that is, if there were a claim here that triggered a duty to defend under my client's policy, it was only the false arrest claim, which accrued as soon as Mr. Dominguez was held under court order, as opposed to the arrest by the officers. That is the only claim that accrued. It was not a claim upon which judgment was entered. The claim upon which judgment was entered was the malicious prosecution-based 1983 claim that I think there is no dispute in this courtroom by anybody didn't accrue and the insured was not rendered liable until exoneration. It was that moment when the city faced liability. And I believe, under the language of the American safety policy, the only triggering language actually in that policy is the language in the condition section identified as policy period. under that provision, it says this policy applies to liability by the named insured, the city, that occurs during the policy period. And I submit that the only meaningful and reasonable way to give that language an interpretation is to say that the policy is triggered when the insured, the named insured, becomes liable. And it's undisputed that at least the liability upon which the judgment was entered, the insured became liable for that in 2002. And therefore, my client would not be covering that liability. So if somehow, in the event this court concluded that the notice was timely to my client, it's our position that my client would not be liable for the judgment that was rendered against the insured. I ask for affirmance, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Crouch. Anything further, Mr. Phillip?
Yes. A few points quickly, please, Your Honor. First, with respect to the argument that was brought up that under Heck versus Humphrey, there is a trigger date hinged to exoneration. When Justice Scalia decided Heck in 1994, he noted that that trigger date under 1983 paralleled the common law rule. So all these cases and all these torts from all these states and all these federal courts have this exoneration trigger date. The entire corpus of precedent before you has that factor present in it. There are multiple decisions. The Third Circuit's decision in Erie, very distinguished panel from 1997, Judge Skorica, Judge Lewis Pollack, sitting by designation on that panel, talked about the difference between accrual dates and insurance coverage dates. The Billings case, a recent case from the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts, talked about this. The City of Broward case from the Southern District of Florida from 2006 talked about that. To the extent this issue has ever been ventilated in the case law, it has expressly rejected the idea that that exoneration date is a trigger under this universe of policies for occurrence coverage. With respect to your question, Your Honor, your very interesting question about the auto insurance policies, I think the answer there is twofold. One, we would have to look at the contracts at issue in that setting, and in this setting, because the language would matter. And with all respect to Scottsdale, I think the amicus position, at least based on everything we've seen, is that there's a substantial degree of uniformity in the contracts in this industry. We would have loved to argue to this court that our contract was different than the McFatridge contract or the contract in the interstate case. They all seem to be materially identical. In this setting, at least, the language of those contracts has been interpreted under this substantial corpus of precedent to put occurrence for personal injury or a personal injury offense at the time an individual is incarcerated or that he's subject to that prosecution. In terms of the fixed and actual point that one of my colleagues was making, that comes from the Baylor case of this court, a 1993 case. There was no fixed and actual liability as to Mr. Dominguez until well after the policy period at issue. He didn't even file a lawsuit until 2 years later. It took another 2 years thereafter, or 4 years after the policies ended as to interstate, before that liability became fixed. In terms of the distinction between 1983 actions and state court actions, these cases cite each other interchangeably all the time. Nothing has ever turned on that in the case law. In terms of the Security Mutual case, the intermediate appellate court case from Illinois from 1979, when it got to the Illinois Supreme Court, and this is at 397 Northeast 2nd, 839 at 842, the Illinois Supreme Court expressly stated that the appellate court committed error by passing upon the merits of the arbitration question. So we don't think that's a valid argument, and that case has been substantially criticized in the ensuing years. Thank you, Your Honors, very much. We'd respectfully ask for relief in this case.
Well, anything further, Mr. Asperger? You have about 30 seconds, my bad.
Your Honors, I want to address Mr. Crouch's statement that the insured was not rendered liable until exoneration. That's not true. The city was not rendered liable until it was found liable in 2006, more than 4 years after the interstate and American safety policies had expired. exoneration was not liability. Mr. Dominguez could have walked away and never filed a lawsuit. There would have been never been a claim against the city. I want to address what the city has said, that American Safety breached its duty to defend. This court in Federal Insurance versus Arthur Anderson stated that there is no duty on the insurer to defend if the insured does not ask for a defense. In this,
thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement. Our second case for argument this morning.